is reconvened. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Ready to call our third case for today, 01-1914-D, OLR, formerly known as the Board of Attorneys Professional Responsibility versus Ronald A. Arthur. Ronald Arthur appearing for himself. Mr. Arthur.
May it please the Court. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to appear this afternoon. I understand that it's unusual for the Court to hear oral argument in discipline cases, and I recognize that you have scheduled this matter sua sponte. I will try my best to make your time investment worthwhile. In my request for oral argument, I suggested that the Court might find it beneficial to meet me in person. Thus, I presume that a large part of my responsibility today is to give the Court some sense of who I am and how my personal characteristics have contributed to the situation at hand. I'd like to begin by introducing my daughter, Haley. Haley is accompanied here today by her fiancé, Michael Stocksannon. Michael's a fine young man and an excellent student who, despite my protestations, is looking forward to attending Harvard Law School. Michael and Haley came up State Street today from the UW campus, where Haley is a sophomore. I'm proud to say that she got all A's in her freshman year and that she's attending college on a Wisconsin Academic Excellence Scholarship after finishing first in her class at Badger High School in Lake Geneva. Haley is the real reason that I'm here today. I've always tried to teach her to do what's right, even when it's difficult and unpopular. Whenever someone stands up for what's right, moral, and ethical, he implicitly impugns the integrity of those who are willing to do wrong. To save face, those censured often rationalize and retaliate. In an effort to exonerate themselves, they excoriate the individual who brought their flaws to light. The more important the principle, the greater the scorn one can expect. Haley has heard me pontificate about this for nearly two decades. Perhaps it made an impression. Obviously, she's doing something right, as evidenced by her success in school and the other aspects of her life. Haley loves movies. We watched hundreds of them together while she was growing up. But I've always told Haley that real life is not like the movies. This ordeal that I've been through and the injustices that I've personally experienced have made this point to Haley more dramatically than 1,000 parental lectures ever could have. And today, I'm sure that Haley is learning about real life in a way that will make an indelible impression. One of my favorite movies is Broadcast News, a 1987 film starring Albert Brooks and Holly Hunter. It's about reporters and anchormen, and my undergraduate degree is in journalism. There is a scene where Albert Brooks is talking about a competing newscaster who is handsome and glib, but he cuts corners and lacks respect for the discipline. In the heat of the moment, Brooks refers to his adversary as the devil. When forced to defend this hyperbole, he says, "What do you think the devil is going to look like? No one's going to be taken in by a guy with a long, red, pointy tail. He'll be attractive. He'll be nice and helpful. He'll get a job where he influences a great, God-fearing nation. And he'll just, bit by little bit, lower our standards where they're important." Well, I'm a moralistic diehard, like the character played by Albert Brooks. I believe that high standards in the legal profession are important, and I'm chagrined by the low standards I have observed. One important standard is intellectual integrity. Some people confuse intellectual integrity with personal integrity, and while both concepts are related and important, intellectual integrity is more subtle. When an important decision must be made, the threat to sagacity seldom comes in the form of an outright lie. lies are relatively easy to identify and counteract. The more insidious danger is that the decision maker himself will circumvent the practices and procedures that distinguish between process and due process. Under a system with intellectual integrity, the process is more important than the outcome. Intellectually honest results flow logically and impartially from a rational decision-making process. However, as our standards have declined bit by little bit in this important area, outcomes are generated ever more capriciously, and the process gets contorted to fit the passions of the decision-maker, who then may attempt to disguise his intellectual dishonesty by making up plausible-sounding rationalizations. Indeed, the degradation of intellectual integrity in the legal system has become epidemic. Conclusory shortcuts and plausible-sounding rationalizations have largely supplanted intellectual integrity in our courtrooms today. And I believe this has contributed to an increase in intellectual dishonesty in other segments of government and society. I'm aware that a couple of years ago, Chief Justice Abramson volunteered to fill a temporary vacancy in Milwaukee County Small Claims Court as a way to get in touch with the justice system at street level. It was a bold experiment, and I'm sure it provided some useful insights. But with all due respect to Chief Justice Abramson and the other outstanding minds on this court, I've got to tell you that you can't really understand Wisconsin's justice system unless you have experienced it as a litigant the way I have. A presiding judge just doesn't have any skin in the game. The perspective from the defendant's table is completely different than the view from behind the bench. I have always encouraged Haley to be suspicious of people in authority. Perhaps it comes from the time when I worked as a member of the Fourth Estate, but I quote the admonition of Lord Acton, who said, "Power tends to corrupt. Absolute power corrupts absolutely." Abraham Lincoln said, "Nearly all men can stand adversity, but if you want to test a man's character, give him power." Well, I have endured quite a bit of adversity in dealing with the Office of Lawyer Regulation, a body that you have endowed with great power. In this case, the power of the OLR corrupted some ordinary logging contracts in some objectively insignificant circumstances into a convoluted tale with sinister overtones. With all due respect to OLR, it's fiction, and what's more, it's bad fiction. When I was in my first year in law school, Professor Ted Finman used his civil procedure class to drum into his students the importance of following an intellectually honest procedure for legal analysis. He taught me to think like a lawyer by analyzing statutory language in the context of its underlying policy objectives. But Professor Finman admitted that he was only teaching us the way lawyers should think. He reluctantly acknowledged that much of what passes for legal analysis in the real world is just a flimsy pretextual justification for a predetermined outcome based on personal prejudices, political preferences, or simple self-interest. Indeed, one of the perverse ironies in this disciplinary proceeding occurred when I attempted to explain to the OLR referee how I had applied Professor Finman's teaching to the relevant ethical decisions that I had made. OLR's counsel so vehemently opposed any such discussion of logic and reasoning that for the sake of expediency, my lawyer and I gave up trying to make the point. Back when I met Professor Finman in law school, I had no intention of ever actually practicing law. I thought that a legal education would provide the best all-around background for whatever vocational interests I might pursue in business, writing, or education. But I did so well in law school that large law firms plied me with offers. And so I joined the real estate team at Godfrey & Kahn and became a downtown lawyer for several years before departing big firm practice in favor of more entrepreneurial pursuits. When I met Jack and Randy Keefe more than a decade ago, both of them were literally bankrupt. I confess to being a bad judge of character. I guess I should have recognized that they were going to be trouble. But, like the devil described in the broadcast news movie, professional con artists don't go around looking like confidence men, or they wouldn't deceive anyone. Ironically, it turned out that the timber harvesting opportunity that the Keefs were promoting as a scam actually had real business potential. Contrary to the spurious allegations, no business failure was involved here. The Keefs just embezzled the earnings and then cried wolf. The details are set out in the briefs and the record, and I won't attempt to reiterate them here. But I do want to focus briefly on some of the elements of the litigation travesty in Juneau County. Ostensibly, the lawsuit there concerned whether I personally could be held vicariously liable for a trespass upon a neighbor's real estate. Yet, no one even bothered to ascertain who it was who actually committed the trespass. And of course, no one established any linkage to justify why I should be vicariously liable for something done by an unknown actor. Moreover, the insignificant dirt trail at a remote corner of the neighbor's parcel caused no economic damage to her property whatsoever. Nevertheless, early on in that litigation, the judge made it clear that such technicalities would not stop him from entering a judgment making me financially liable to the plaintiff, who was a local resident, not a rich big city carpet bagger. If I had been representing a client instead of appearing as a defendant, I would have faced an ethical dilemma. On one hand, the attorney's oath requires that I maintain the respect due the courts of justice and judicial officers. On the other hand, SCR 20:1.4 would have required that I fully explain the situation to my client. As is my custom, I would have resolved the dilemma by applying the principles taught by Professor Finman. Since SCR 20:8.2 prohibits only false statements regarding the integrity of a judge, and since the Supreme Court rules exist to protect the public, not to cast a veil of secrecy over the misconduct of judicial officials, I would have concluded that my primary duty compelled me to tell my client the hard truth about his situation. And the hard truth was that Judge Brady had made it clear he simply had no intention of providing a fair trial or attempting to arrive at a fair result. The hard truth was that Judge Brady had objectively exhibited his intention to abuse his authority in order to induce an outsider to swallow an unfair settlement with a favored local resident. If I had been representing a client, I would have told him that once a judge has thus telegraphed his plans to ignore the established law and the exculpatory facts, then the economically rational thing to do is make the best settlement you can and cut your losses. I would have told my client that, for good or bad, the judicial system vests a great amount of discretion in the hands of largely unsupervised circuit court judges, and as an unfortunate corollary, any given judge may from time to time abuse that discretion. I would have told my client that the judicial system includes an appeals process for just such circumstances. But I also would have told him that appeals are very expensive, and even when both the law and the facts are clearly on an appellant's side, there exists a significant risk that the Court of Appeals might simply sidestep all the important issues and affirm the trial court per curiam. I also would have told the client that SCR 20:8.3b requires that lawyers like myself, who possess knowledge of judicial misconduct, are supposed to report it to the appropriate professional authorities. But I also would have told him that reporting misconduct of this sort could not be expected to have any positive effect on his particular circumstances. But I wasn't representing a client. I was the client. And given what I knew about the case, including Attorney Schmuckler's fraudulent misconduct and the forgery of evidentiary documents, I believed that the moral and ethical requirements of my position as a lawyer precluded me from taking the easy way out and making a payoff settlement to buy my peace. I took seriously the words of the preamble to the Rules of Professional Conduct, where it states that it is a lawyer's duty, when necessary, to challenge the rectitude of official action. I also gave respect to the preamble statement that, as a public citizen, a lawyer should seek improvement of the law and the administration of justice. As a member of a learned profession, a lawyer should employ his knowledge in reform of the law. A lawyer should be mindful of deficiencies in the administration of justice, and a lawyer should aid the legal profession in pursuing noble objectives and should help the bar regulate itself in the public interest. Thus, in order to be true to myself and my sense of professional responsibility, I believed that I had no choice but to follow the relevant legal procedures to their ultimate conclusion, wherever that might lead. But I must say, in my wildest dreams, I had no idea that they might lead here. So I stand before you today as a matter of conscience, unbroken and unbowed by the ordeal I have been through. I have put my time, money, and reputation at risk to defend the principles articulated in the high language of the preamble to the Rules of Professional Conduct. For this, counsel for OLR has castigated me for failing to express remorse over what I have done. But I don't take it personally. I'm sure that the attorneys acting on behalf of OLR conducted themselves exactly as they believed you wanted them to. From the investigators to the preliminary review committee to staff counsel, litigation counsel, and the referee, I am confident that everyone thought it was their job to do whatever was necessary to arrive at the outcome expressed in the referee's report. OLR's counsel today will tell you that a lot of good people have reached the conclusion that I must have done something wrong. But he will say very little about how they reached that conclusion. If OLR's counsel talks at all about the evidence or the process, it will be in generalities and in conclusory terms. Disciplinary proceedings should showcase the judicial system at its best. These are original jurisdiction proceedings here in the Supreme Court. Due process is supposed to be accorded scrupulous respect. Theoretically, the proceeding is a non-adversarial search for the truth, and the burden of proof calls for clear and convincing evidence. Moreover, individual circumstances are subordinate to the overarching importance of defining the vital role that lawyers play in the preservation of society. So the question now becomes, is this it? Is this really the best the legal system can do? Does what happened here in my case really reflect what the preamble calls the proper application of the rules of professional conduct? Personally, I've gone to great lengths and great expense to do the right thing. I'm here today so that Haley will never forget that I backed up my words with action and that when the offer was made, I refused to sell my soul. Along the way, my moralistic attitude has clearly irritated some judges and lawyers. Perhaps it has irritated some of you as well. And if so, with all due respect, I regard that as a good thing, because that means I have succeeded in demonstrating what this disciplinary proceeding is really all about. At that point, I'll close my argument if you don't have any questions.
Arthur, what do you view as the primary charges against you? This has been going on since, what, 1995? There are boxes.
You know, I could make an analysis of the case, and at one point I offered to stipulate to the facts and allow the court to make a determination as to what, if any, punishment was appropriate. In fact, I tried very hard to stipulate to the facts, and was rebuffed repeatedly by the OLR with all of my efforts in that regard. I think that this case, in actuality, is about protecting a decision made by a judge in Juneau County that no one wants to admit was made badly.
Which decision was that, Mr. Arthur?
That was in the Doyle versus Arthur
case. Default judgment?
That was a default judgment, yes.
Against you?
Against me, yes. It was a default judgment that took place long after issue had actually been joined in that matter, but I was deemed to be in default, notwithstanding the fact that I had moved for a motion to dismiss the complaint for failure to state a claim. In fact, in that court, I made that motion three times. Three different times, it was rejected without consideration. The complaint then, to this date, doesn't state a claim upon which relief can be granted. But the findings of fact and conclusions of law were entered, and since that time, OLR, the investigators, and various other people have adamantly stood fast as if those findings of fact were actual facts.
Several of these complaints dealt with your being in business with clients.
Yes. Well, actually, in the final analysis, it seems to me very little had to do with that. There was certainly a circumstance where loggers were hired to do logging, and there was a determination made on my part that the exception to the rule, which relates to engaging in business with clients in their ordinary course of business, was applicable. I recognize that that's a point which could be debated, and that's why in the early stages of this process, in an effort to attempt to bring this to a head, I said that I was willing to stipulate to all of the relevant facts relating to that. I acknowledged that I didn't obtain a waiver, and if that was the be-all and end-all in the analysis, then I throw myself upon the court to determine what the appropriate sanction should be. I think that my analysis, applying Professor Finman's rules, was correct, that I was merely doing business with clients who had specialized expertise, and therefore I had no position where I could take advantage of them. They had the opportunity to take advantage of me, and they did take advantage of me in that setting. But that one instance is something that I can certainly say reasonable minds could disagree over.
Just one. In your statement, you indicated that the property, sort of the original lawsuit, I believe it belonged to Barbara Doyle.
Yes.
That it was not injured in any way. I just recall reading that at least there was a 200-foot road, 10 feet wide, and apparently there were six trees, oak trees. Did that actually happen, or are you saying that that did not exist?
No.
As far as the damage?
There was an actual dirt logging road across a very remote corner of an irregularly shaped property. The six trees, as far as I can tell from the efforts of a surveyor later, actually were removed. What happened, though, was that it was stipulated after I put on expert testimony that there was no diminution in the value of the property. The court there used the alternative method of damages and honestly put on a witness to say that if they helicoptered in six large oak trees onto this steep hillside, that it would cost about $35,000. And so that was what the court used as a measure of damage instead of what the law requires, which is a diminution in value.
Mr. Arthur, it's my understanding that the Office of Lawyer Regulation is asking for revocation of your license to practice law. Do you concede that there should be any sanction, and if so, what are you arguing for?
Well, I was willing to say a long time ago and continue to be willing to say that there is no doubt that I did not obtain a waiver. There are questions as to whether the people, the individuals involved, were actually clients at that point, and whether I owed them the duty, or whether I was required to obtain that waiver in connection with these circumstances where I was buying services in the ordinary course of a client's specialized business. That's the only item of all of the litany of charges which holds any substance. And to tell you the truth, I think that a matter like that, if it had been addressed the way things normally are addressed, probably would have been a private reprimand. Well, pretty much that horse has left the barn. I think that, whatever would happen at this point, that's appropriate compared to the other sanctions I've read, it would be pretty insignificant. But I wouldn't mind, I would encourage the court to clarify those issues for other lawyers who, like myself, might read the comment to that rule and believe that it should have applied in a case like this. But if the court's determination is that it should not have applied in a case like this, then I think that other lawyers would benefit from knowing that. My red light has come on. I don't know if that means anything in this context or not at this point.
It means your time is up unless anyone on the court has any questions, sir. And I see none. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Thank you. Counsel for the Office of Lawyer Regulation.
May it please the court, Mr. Arthur. The Office of Lawyer Regulation has prosecuted Mr. Arthur through the hearings with the referee, and the referee has recommended certain findings that you have all before you. They're detailed, they're very specific, they're 6 in numbers related to violations. And with all due respect to Mr. Arthur and his personal approach to this court, what we are here to do is to talk about the facts and the law. And so the issues here are readily before the court as they were with the referee, and the standard of review, of course, is whether or not the referee's findings, his conclusions, are clearly erroneous. And the referee prepared a 43-page report. Within that report, citations to the specific record related to facts, documents, transcript pages are all identified. It's very, very specific. Now, with regard to that 43-page report, not only has the court found violations, the referee found violations, also conclusions, the ultimate conclusion is that Mr. Arthur's license should be revoked. And when you look at all of the violations, starting with the prohibited transactions, which are conflict of interest issues, which really started this whole process from 1992 all the way through these proceedings, keeping in mind the fact that Mr. Arthur has disputed each and every allegation and each and every violation, which I think the court has to realize, and I'm sure it already does, that our job as representation of the OLR is to fully evaluate whatever information is brought to our attention, fully evaluate the facts, the documents, and exhibits. And that was done. And then the complaint was filed on July 13, 2001. And then the trial was commenced August 14, 2002. So there was almost 13 months in addition to the pre-litigation time that Mr. Arthur had ample opportunity to, one, know what those accusations were, which then became complaints and then became violations, to respond. And he had an ample opportunity to do so. And when we start with, number one, the conflicts, the prohibited transactions, everything else in terms of violations 2 through 5 flow from that. Two, we have the harassment litigation, and the record speaks clearly as to the harassment litigation. To the extent that Mr. Arthur, as courts, state courts, have found that his wife, Mrs. Arthur, was being used as the attorney of record, essentially as a, quote, beard to disguise the actual control of the case, quoting Judge Kirk. And that's, in fact, what was happening. When you look at the record, you have to go deep into the record, as I did, to ascertain that particular conclusion. And when you look at it, you see why Judge Brady, a longtime experienced judge in the state, took the measure of imposing $75,000 in punitive damages against Mr. Arthur for his conduct. Now, we can talk all we want about moralistic, ethical issues, Ted Finman, whomever else. But when a judge hears a case where an experienced, as Mr. Arthur suggests, very bright, accomplished lawyer does not answer a complaint but continues to fly-spec issues concerning motions to dismiss and whatever, the case went on appeal through the Court of Appeals. All the issues Mr. Arthur is challenging and re-challenging and making mashed potatoes out of baked potatoes here was all litigated at the Court of Appeals, went to the Supreme Court. He lost on every ground, and he continues to litigate that case with OLR. The fact of the matter is, when you lose, that doesn't mean you've been denied due process. You lost. So we have to deal with that, but not to continue to relitigate it with these proceedings from Mr. Arthur's standpoint. Then we have, in addition to Judge Brady, and keep in mind, he wrote about a 40-page findings on this issue related to the Doyle matter. That included the $75,000 in punitive damages. What did that cause, for example, counsel on the other side to go through? Mr. Schmuckler. $100,000 of his time was spent in pursuing this, quote, simple trespass case, unquote, with Mr. Arthur on the other side. $100,000. Why did that happen? Because of Mr. Arthur's extreme tactics in litigation, which eventually led Judge Brady to conclude not only is the plaintiff entitled to $34,000, but also entitled to $75,000 in punitives. Now let's find out what, as a lawyer, practicing lawyer, as Mr. Arthur was, he receives a judgment as a litigant that goes through the Court of Appeals, Wisconsin Supreme Court, for $109,000, including punitive damages. Does Mr. Arthur pay one dime on that judgment? Negative. Now, we, as members of the bar, and as part of the Office of Lawyer Regulation, have a responsibility to the bar, to those practicing members who have to pay for these proceedings, and we as members of the bar have a responsibility to honor our obligations. We can talk moralistic, ethical issues and Ted Finman all we want, but was there any effort to pay that? No. What has happened here, and this reflects on Mr. Arthur's revocation recommendation by the referee, is that instead of paying that, he went to Walworth County without disclosing to Judge Brady or anyone else and prepared a document with his wife transferring any and all assets and any debts, basically, that he had personally to her and had some family court commissioner assistant sign it without knowing any of this fact. And then later on, as the record shows, transferred any assets he had to other organizations to defeat the payment of these claims and judgments. And then we have appearances before different courts by Mr. Arthur, in which he has submitted, as Judge McGarity, the bankruptcy court finds, a false claim concerning any assets, claims that he has. Now, Judge McGarity has nothing to do with Judge Brady. We have him appearing in front of Judge Wright, experienced trial judge, Marquette. Judge Wright finds that essentially he violated his fiduciary duties to his client, disqualified himself for any further matters involving Mr. Arthur because, in Judge Brady's view, in Judge Wright's view, he was a liar. And he could not have Mr. Arthur appear in his court and impartially deal with that. Similarly, Judge Brady found the same conclusion. Then we have an issue that Mr. Arthur raised in his briefs, that Milwaukee County Judge Crivello essentially was supporting him based upon what Judge Wright had done. And in his brief submitted in April of this year, Mr. Arthur suggests that. Well, Judge Crivello did, in fact, make a finding supportive of Mr. Arthur back in 1997, believing, as Mr. Arthur had represented at the hearing, that Judge Wright had decided an issue that was dispositive of this case. It was a misrepresentation. Judge Maroney vacated that decision by Judge Crivello, and in vacating it, he said Ronald Arthur committed fraud on the court. That was in February of this year. So Mr. Arthur raises the issue that he has Milwaukee County supporting him in these decisions in a document submitted to this court, in April of 2004, knowing full well that Judge Maroney vacated that decision and found he committed fraud in the court. So what does that tell you about the moralistic, ethical issues that have been pontificated here? What has Mr. Arthur come to this court with, making a representation about Milwaukee County Circuit Court Judge Crivello's decision? What it tells you is that you as a court have now been blessed and touched, like Judge Brady, Judge McGarity, Judge Kirk, Judge Wright, OLR, and the other counsel who have been adversaries of Mr. Arthur. So, when we talk about the violations here, when we get to the point of, we haven't even touched now, the cost of litigation that Mr. Arthur has incurred everyone to incur, it's because of his litigation methods, strategies, and I can't blame this one on Ted Finman. I was in law school too, and I know about Ted Finman. I don't think he would be particularly pleased with this, but that's another issue. So the point I'm trying to make is, Mr. Arthur has gone to various lengths and to various courts, representing himself to be one thing, as he has today in his eloquence, but actually is another. It's a perception reality issue. He refers to his initial clients, which formed the basis of this prohibited transaction, the Keefs, and they, of course, in his view, the court, the bad guys, and he, being the very experienced real estate attorney who presented himself to them, in his brief to this court, on page 20, referring to his clients, these people who basically were able to victimize Mr. Arthur. It actually starts on page 19, middle of the paragraph, last paragraph. Mr. Arthur, quoting, that's his brief. Admittedly, on Wall Street, where they routinely work on billion-dollar mergers, international technology transfers, global REITs, there probably are more than a few cynical lawyers and investment bankers who consider Wisconsin a backwater locale where a complicated joint venture can involve little more than a couple of bankrupt hillbillies in an old pickup, some broken-down logging equipment, and a rusty sawmill and a ramshackle lean-to. Now, those are real con men. He then goes on to say, but if this court, the Wisconsin Supreme Court, adopts the referee's report, that will define the standard of a complicated joint venture project in this state. And East Coast businessmen will have good reason to dismiss Wisconsinites in general as a just bunch of rubes and yokels. Now, that sounds like someone who has really become accountable and responsible for one's actions, doesn't it? No, it's a belittling approach, a condescending approach to not only the integrity of this system of courts, his obligations as a lawyer to his clients, to our fellow practicing bar members, and to the public in general. So when he goes in front of an appellate court during the time Judge Brady is writing his decision and says by a petition for supervisory writ, Judge John Brady, you and your brother Wallace Brady essentially have conspired to deny me my rights, and you both have bias and ulterior motives. When questioned on that very subject during the course of this trial and the hearings, what specific evidence do you have that Judge Wallace Brady and or Judge John Brady had bias and ulterior motives that were personal to Ronald Arthur? He had none. He had zero. So when you have a judge who's issuing a decision in the process, for this Mr. Arthur to then file such a frivolous action in the Court of Appeals, accusing bias and ulterior motives of Judge John Brady without any evidence whatsoever. These are the lengths to which this top-of-the-line lawyer from the University of Wisconsin Law School practices. And that's the type of practice that he presents to this court and to the legal system in Wisconsin. And then we move into count number four, which involves false statements to a tribunal. False. We've touched on that. The evidence is clear. The record is clear from each state court judge. And then we have, during the course of the proceedings, the trial itself, one of the Keefes is scheduled to testify on September 18th. The timber theft issue that was a dispute between Arthur and the Keefes dated back to 1994. What does he do the day before Mr. Keefe gets to testify, who's already completely shocked by all this behavior? He files a complaint with the Department of Consumer Protection in the state of Wisconsin, claiming a judgment was entered against Mr. Keefe for timber theft. Now, if that isn't a form of retaliation for Mr. Keefe testifying, bringing this grievance, if that isn't a way to intimidate someone, I don't know what is. And that particular complaint also was false because there was no judgment entered, as he alleged. But to wait 10 years until, or 9 years before he testified, is this type of attitude and behavior and tactics that was shown throughout his representation of the Keefes. On top of that, now, number five, we talk about soliciting perjury involving Mr. Zupfer. When you have a lawyer and the referee found, with the record support, to direct a client not to appear at a court-ordered deposition, when you have a lawyer concealing an attorney-client relationship, when you have a lawyer telling the client to testify falsely, not only is that a legal issue, an ethical issue, it's a regulatory issue. This court cannot countenance perjury. It's the core value of an attorney-client relationship. This Mr. Arthur broke down that core value by soliciting perjury. So let's talk about conflicts of interest. Let's talk about harassing people. Let's talk about punitive damage of $75,000 against him. Let's talk about forcing a simple trespass case to the tune of $100,000. Let's talk about making false statements to state court judges, federal judges. Let's talk about taking assets to defeat payment of obligations and accountability. Then let's talk about perjury. What's left? How about fraud, deceit, dishonesty, and misrepresentation, which is count 6? What haven't we covered here? And it's all been generated by Mr. Arthur's conduct, Mr. Arthur's documents. He has been his own worst enemy by creating these documents, executing on them, using the instrumentality and means to effectuate the result, which is wrongful misconduct causing serious damage to the integrity of our system, to the public, his clients. So when you come to the ultimate decision of what your recommended discipline is, the referee accurately stated there can be no other reasonable conclusion by the repeated pattern of conduct, by his own documents, his own exhibits, his own conduct. He has generated it all. No one else has done it but him. So when you talk about moralistic issues, as Mr. Arthur has claimed here, when we look at the reality of the record of what he has done over a 10-year period, which each court has found or other lawyers have found, when he intimidated Mr. Schmuckler with 4 separate letters threatening him by personally suing him, personally referring to the Board of Attorneys professional responsibility. He did the same thing with Attorney Pinker up in Door County. While this is all going on, he was the master of multitask, compartmentalization. This was a busy man in 1992 to 95. He was attacking everybody. And when he sent a statement of legal services to the Keefs in 1995, June 9th, it's Exhibit 4, that statement of legal services identifies with great particularity from his own hand what legal services he did, what business services he did. And when asked at the hearing and trial, what do you say about this? This is a statement of legal services. It specifically says it. He says that's not what it is. Well, what is it? What is the meaning of the word is? So this is the kind of person, when he refers to the Keefs as con men, the hillbillies in a pickup truck in a lean-to in a ramshackle, he says they're the con men. Is that reasonable under the circumstances? Who is the con man? Seems like every judge before whom he's appeared relating to this matter figured it out. The lawyers figured it out, and OLR figured it out, and the referee figured it out. The only one who apparently hasn't figured it out is Mr. Arthur. And the only way to get the message clear under the Charlton case is this court has to decide a sanction that reflects the seriousness of the offense. What is more serious than these 6 violations? At the core value of what a lawyer is supposed to do. Number 2, protection of the public. The public must be protected from this behavior. It's risky behavior. What has it done to every fabric in our legal system? Number 3, impressing upon the lawyer the seriousness of the misconduct. That obviously hasn't been done here because he continues to deny everything. There is no mitigation of damage. There is no remorse. There's no accountability. Instead, we take the money and go somewhere else, and we don't pay our obligations. And then number 4, to deter other attorneys from engaging similar misconduct. The only message that this court can give to protect the practicing bar, to honor the integrity of the system, and to tell other judges and lawyers that this cannot be approved, countenanced in any form, shape, or manner, is to revoke the license. The referee found that. And there's been no statement here today from Mr. Arthur, in addition to his brief, to indicate...
Counsel, you'll have to stand in front of the microphone. All right, thank you.
To indicate any sort of accountability. And there's nothing to show that the findings were not clearly erroneous. And I wish to address one of the exhibits that was introduced, Exhibit 129 in this record. It was brought on by a witness that the OLR called. His name was Attorney Labros. And we talk about responsibilities to our brethren, to the court, integrity, and Mr. Arthur continued to talk about integrity and moral, ethical issues to this court. When you've done all of these things that Mr. Arthur has done and not been accountable, and during the course of this compartmentalization and multitask activity, attacking lawyers, attacking judges, suing judges, he sued Judge Harvey, he sued Jerome Brendel during the course of a proceeding in Waukesha, all when this is going on, to get them out of the case. His replacement lawyer, Arthur Labros, testifies, introducing Exhibit 129, a letter he wrote to Mr. Arthur, after Mr. Arthur threatened his prior lawyer, Mr. Brendel, to Mr. Labros by telling Mr. Labros about what he's going to do to Mr. Brendel unless Mr. Brendel agrees with what he wants him to do. And Mr. Labros testified specifically to this exhibit. He testified again, that's what happened. This is the letter that Labros stated that Mr. Arthur told him. Quote, "You further stated that you have John Brendel by the, quote, nuts, unquote, and that you were going to jerk them for the next 5 years by starting another action unless we all agreed to your terms." That's on top of everything else. He boasted to the Keefs that he and his DA wife could tie people up in litigation from 2 to 5 years. When I asked Mr. Arthur to confront this exhibit during the course of the trial, he said he never got it, never saw it, never said it, period, the end. We called 8 witnesses at this hearing. Mr. Arthur called none, except, of course, himself. And in courtesy to Mr. Brown, his attorney, I allowed him to do that out of order. No witnesses. This case has been going on since mid-1990s, 96. If everybody was so supportive of Mr. Arthur in his view of the world and his role in the world, there were no witnesses except Mr. Arthur. And Mr. Arthur became his own worst witness. That's what the referee found. Those findings are not clearly erroneous. They are the facts. And what we're here to do is tell you the facts, and that's what this brief was all about, that's what this argument's all about, and that's what the referee, an experienced referee, we're not talking about a first-time caller here. Mr. Hack has been doing this for a long, long time, and he was patient. He allowed Mr. Arthur to do everything he needed to do to present his case. So, I'm yellow, and so before I go red, if you have any other questions or any questions, I invite you.
I've got a question in regard to the costs in this matter. As I understand it, the costs are approximately $140,000. Do you have any explanation as to why the costs are that high?
Yes, I do. And when this case came in, it was, I believe, the end of 2000, beginning of 2001. Prior to my involvement in the case, I don't believe any of the time spent by the Board of Attorneys Professional Responsibility and OLR has been part of this cost. It's all lawyers' fees, referees' fees, and other costs related to this matter. When this case first came in front of Judge or Referee Hack in September of 2001. He set up a series of scheduling conferences, which you do as a referee. And a complaint had been filed. Mr. Arthur filed his answer, disputing everything, every detail. Mr. Arthur then filed 7 requests to admit. The OLR responded to each one. Mr. Arthur filed 14 pre-hearing motions. OLR responded to every one. And the scheduling conferences that were held before Referee Hack, in which I attended, 90% of these scheduling conferences, which in some instances went 4 to 5 hours listening to Mr. Arthur. If you look at the transcripts, 90% of those scheduling conferences was Mr. Arthur talking. Now you look at the paper trail that forms the basis of 186 exhibits generated for the most part by Mr. Arthur. Business deals, memorandums of understanding, agreements, joint venture agreements, everything Arthur drafted. Now, in fairness to Mr. Arthur, I, as OLR counsel, had to look at these documents, find out where they came from, what they were related to, and then, because part of the allegations, violations occurring, involved jurisdictions, lawsuits that Mr. Arthur was involved in, criminal charges Mr. Arthur was alleging. When you have to go through all these multiple jurisdictions, Marquette County, Dodge County, every county possible, and then there's counterclaims and motions, and that's what Mr. Schmuckler tuned into $100,000 about. Then you have to go to Jefferson County, where Mr. Zupfer was located. He was a prisoner at the time. We had to take his testimony. We had to go to Marquette County to take testimony with Judge Wright. We had to go to Juneau County to get Judge Brady's testimony. And then we had to go over all the documents and litigation in which Mr. Arthur was involved in, which was enormous. This man was busy. And so we had to go through it in fairness to him, because if what he was saying was true and correct from our viewpoint, we'll take care of that in terms of whatever the modifications of the violations are. Unfortunately for Mr. Arthur, every time we looked at a new document, every time we went to a transcript, every time we went to another source or fact, it was not helpful to Mr. Arthur. It reinforced our position that this is a bad situation and these violations must continue. So Judge Kirk's case, it was uncovered during the course of this investigation. And again, we evaluate what Mr. Arthur was saying so that it could be properly and fairly reviewed. Now what do we have? 186 exhibits. We've got 3,600 pages of transcript. We've got thousands and thousands of pages of documents. We then have a 1,000-plus page compendium that Mr. Arthur prepared. We've got 500 pages of discovery demands that Mr. Arthur submitted to OLR. Does that surprise me in light of what he was doing in the other litigation with Mr. Schmuckler, with other lawyers that he's touched by his obsessive litigation strategy? No. And so this took a lot of time to put together. This is not a simple case of embezzling. This case had a paper trail that was the classic white-collar crime prosecution, from money laundering all the way down the load. And that's what I had to do. And that's what we did do. And at $60 an hour, that's a lot of dedication. That's one-third of what the typical lawyer is going to be paid for, lost opportunity. But we're committed to do this, to do the right thing. Mr. Arthur, the one thing he said today that I can agree with, do the right thing. We did the right thing. Unfortunately, Mr. Arthur did not, in the eyes of the law. And the other thing I'll mention to you, in fairness to Mr. Arthur also, is that the referee asked me, and you'll see it in his report, very detailed citations to the record. Well, who do you think put those citations together in the memorandum in support of the proposed findings of fact by OLR? OLR. I did. What did he want? He wanted each exhibit by number, by page, by line. And he wanted each transcript, page number, by line. Yellow lining. So by the time he gets it, the cake has been in the oven, out, and ready to eat. And so I did that. I did that at $60 an hour. Why? Because he asked me to. That's our job. And our job is to do the right thing to bring it to this court's attention and to make sure that protection of the public is made, make sure the integrity of this process is adhered to, so that each lawyer who appears in front of you gets the message. No perjury, no harassment, no conflicts, no false statements to this court or any other court, no fraud, deceit, because that's what we should be doing. So I hope that answers your question.
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Are there any further questions?
Thank you very much.
And none. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Arthur, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
I'm a big fan of the TV show The West Wing. In one episode, a congressman tells a story about a Jewish friend of his who's a nightclub comic. One evening, after a particularly good show, a group of West German businessmen came backstage to compliment the comedian. One of the businessmen said, "I don't know why we don't have anyone as funny as you back home." And the congressman's friend replied, "It's because you killed them all." I hope that it's been helpful for you to have a chance to look me in the eye today, to listen to my voice, and take your own measure of whether I'm truly the evil man that OLR has described me as. In any event, I thank you for your attention and this opportunity. Unless you have any further questions, that's all I have.
There are no questions, Mr. Arthur. On behalf of the court, I want to thank you for appearing, and I want to thank Mr. Ayer for appearing on behalf of OLR. Discipline cases are never easy for the lawyer involved or OLR, this court. So we appreciate your appearances. That closes the hearing on 01-1914-D, OLR, formerly known as Board of Attorneys Professional Responsibility versus Ronald A. Arthur. The court is in recess until later in October when we will complete our October docket of cases and we'll meet in the conference room at 3:10.
Thank you.